Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Ethics Talk. My name is Hope May, and I'm joined tonight by our Ethics Talk regulars, Nicholas Rousseau.
Hello.
And Sarah Wills.
Hello.
And also on the line with me is a very special guest, Andre Sossler, who's the executive director of the Darfur Stoves Project. Thank you so much, Andre, for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us on Ethics Talk.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
And so, if you're unaware, for the past month during November, Central Michigan University has been hosting Human Rights Month. And actually, our conversation with Andre tonight is really the last event in this series of events. And if you missed any of those events, and they've included interviews such as one we're doing with Andre tonight, as well as screenings of films, Invisible Children, The Reckoning, Skylight Pictures, all of that material has been archived, whether it's audio or video, and you can access it on humanrightsmonth.com. And so, with that, I just want to say where we're going with the show tonight, and then I'm going to hand it over to Nick. And what we want you, the listener, to come away with after this show is to have an understanding of the important work that Andre does with the Darfur Stoves Project is, what the Darfur Stoves Project is, what the Darfur Stove is, and what it does. And also, as I understand it, Andre, you have recently returned from Darfur, is that correct?
That's right.
And you were there for 3 weeks?
I was there for 3 weeks and just got back last week.
Wow. Okay, so you just got back. And so we will want to discuss what you did on your most recent trip, and that was not your first visit to Darfur, correct?
That's right. I was there about a year ago also.
Okay. So with that, that's where we're going with the show, and so I'm going to turn it over to Nick.
Thanks again, Andre, for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. And to start off, I guess we just kind of want to get a character outline of who Andre is, and, you know, it's obviously going to be quite the short version. But from what we've gathered, you have an MBA from the Wharton School at Penn and an AB in Developmental Studies at Brown. Here at CMU, we don't have a development studies major, so I was wondering if you could just speak on exactly kind of what that entails.
Sure. It's sort of like international relations, focusing on developing countries. It was a rather new major when I was at Brown, but it basically had most of the same requirements as international relations, except that it also required that you study abroad and that you do so in a developing country, and that you write a thesis either related to the work that you did when you were studying abroad or on another topic relating to something in a developing country.
Wow, that sounds like a cool program. CMU should get on the ball and get something like that going.
Did you actually study abroad in Africa?
I did. That was my first time in Africa. I went to Cameroon in Central Africa.
Wow.
Interesting. Well, was it your studies that brought you to the Darfur issue and started you on the path towards creating this entity of Darfur Stoves?
Mm-hmm. My studies brought me to Africa, but I'm relatively new to Darfur. I had done a lot of work in the economic development field and less in the more humanitarian field, like post-conflict situations such as Darfur. And I came to this project just about a year ago. It had been a volunteer project at University of California, Berkeley, and I was brought in as the first full-time staff person.
And so, as Nick said, after you received your undergraduate degree from Brown in Development Studies, you then went on to graduate school to get an MBA. And so after you finished your degree in Development Studies, were you then sort of keen on the economic aspect of developing countries, and that was motivating you to get an MBA?
That's part of it. I've always been really interested in economics and partially regret not having double majored with economics in college. But also my interest came from the fact that I worked for about 5 years in between my undergraduate and my graduate studies. And I worked in a field called microfinance, so providing small loans to mostly women in developing countries to help them start or expand businesses. And the place I worked, called the Trickle Up Program, actually provided grants instead of loans to the very poorest people. So in that sense, working on a very micro scale, I became interested in the sort of microeconomics of development. And I also became really interested in less on the economic side, but more on the organizational management side, you could say. I had a lot of experience working with grassroots non-governmental organizations or NGOs in Africa through my job with Trickle Up. And I was really fascinated by the ways in which some of them really worked and accomplished a lot and others not so much. And so I really wanted to study, you know, what is it that makes organizations work? And also in my own experience working with other American organizations, seeing some that were sort of stagnating and making the same mistakes over and over and not really progressing, I was really interested in kind of seeing what factors influence that. So I thought about going and studying organizational psychology. And so I spent a year sort of going back and doing undergraduate psychology courses at Columbia University and doing research in group decision making, and decided that research that I was doing was really theoretical and I wasn't quite sure that my personality was right for getting a PhD. I'm really kind of interested in a lot of things. I kind of see myself as a generalist. So with that, I decided, you know, MBA makes more sense. I still get to learn about management. I felt like the nonprofit world is kind of moving in the direction of relying on a lot more people with business backgrounds. And in addition, I was really interested by a lot of the social enterprises that have been emerging recently, which are for-profit companies that have social missions or goals, because I thought that those might have an interesting and different approach to addressing some of the world's social problems. So I thought an MBA could help me potentially work in a social enterprise.
One of the things that you mentioned a couple times was, what was it, the Trickle Up
program? That's right.
Program. Can you just speak on that a little bit and what that is?
Sure. It's a nonprofit organization based in New York City that has programs around the world. It's focused in its program somewhat since I was there. When I worked there from 2001 to 2004, I worked in the Africa program, and we worked in 9 countries in Africa. I believe they're in fewer countries now, but provide more services in each place that they work. And we provided small grants at the time of $100 in two installments of $50 each to very poor entrepreneurs, many of whom are living on less than a dollar a day, but we're doing a lot of petty trading or animal husbandry. And we did this through local partner organizations, grassroots community-based organizations or non-governmental organizations. So a lot of what I did was go to Africa for, you know, a month or 2 months at a time and work on providing training to these local organizations or monitoring their work or reaching out to find new organizations to partner with. And that really just, that experience really solidified my interest in Africa.
Well, moving on to kind of the African experience, or the experience of Africa, we found somewhere in our research that you've been to 15 different countries in Africa.
I think that's right. Somewhere in there, yeah.
You stopped counting.
Yeah, and some of them, you know, it's been when I was living most recently before I moved here to Berkeley, I was living in Rwanda, and when I was there, I also went on vacation to a number of other African countries, so I sometimes lose count which ones were working and which ones were just for holiday.
Well, do you want to maybe just give, like, one anecdote of something separate from Darfur Stoves that you were doing in Africa, kind of the work that you were doing there?
Mm-hmm. Well, probably most of those countries that I visited was during my time at Trickle Up, where I went around and visited our grassroots partner organizations. Early on, some of the things that I was doing that were really exciting was a leading in training of trainers sessions. So we had developed these tools to train illiterate entrepreneurs on basic business skills, like the difference between startup costs and recurring costs, for example, or how to do a feasibility study, or you know, the idea of competition or added value. And we had created tools to teach these with mostly images and skits and role-playing and things like that. So what we would do is teach our partner organizations to teach the entrepreneurs. So I would sometimes organize meetings of a number of our partner organizations from, you know, a few different neighboring countries who would all come together. They would share experiences about their work with our program, and then we would go through this training process. And that was just a ton of fun, and really loved that.
Interesting. Maybe could you speak a little bit on the cultural difference between Africa as a country versus, or as a continent versus, I guess, the North American kind of states model that we find ourselves in?
Yeah, well, it's a big question. There are many, many differences. Even within Africa, I find a lot of differences. Every time I go to a new place, I'm constantly learning new rules and new ways of thinking and seeing things. But some of the sort of universal differences that I noticed between Africa and the U.S. Would be, for one thing, the gender roles. So I think especially in my early years working in Africa, in my early 20s when I was with Trickle Up, and I would go and I'd work with these local grassroots organizations, and some of them might have, a lot of them actually were, you know, women's rights organizations. They'd be called, you know, like Women United or whatever. And all of their staff, and particularly their senior staff, sometimes not always their field staff, but the senior staff were always men and older men. And so here I would be leading trainings with, you know, 50-year-old men, and I just often wondered what they thought of me as a woman, since, you know, they very rarely would hire women in senior positions, and here I was as a woman and a much younger woman. So that's one difference that has always been a really interesting challenge for me. But again, that's not universal. As I mentioned that I was living in Rwanda before I moved here, and that's actually quite different in Rwanda. Rwanda actually has, I think, the highest number of females in government of any country in the world, and a lot of them are young women. So I can't even say that that's, you know, true across Africa.
Right, and I think that's interesting just because it seems like sometimes when you look at Africa as a continent, it seems like there's this way of classifying it kind of all as this, you know, I even slipped up with my words and almost classified it as a country rather than a continent. And so actually the reality of it, as you described it, it seems like a very diverse place where, you know, there's very different cultures just from place to place within a country in Africa.
Absolutely.
That said, we do have a caller, so
okay.
We're going to take that and see if our caller has a good question or comment or something.
Okay, so caller, caller, you are on Ethics Talk. Are you there? 616.
I think we're getting the silent treatment.
Sometimes people just prank call us. That's fine. Or maybe they just want to listen. But okay. Or maybe there's a bad connection, so they're not there anymore. Okay.
So yeah, we were just. I don't know. Did you want to comment at all on just kind of? Do you see the perception of Africa in terms of the states as being this kind of general identity that we throw on to Africa?
Absolutely. Yes. I think you really nailed it on the head. Everybody's always like, so what's it like? And it's such a big place that it's really hard to say.
Right. And so even my question about trying to compare it to the states is like, it's not even close to the same. And I would say that, you know, in the states that, you know, traveling from state to state, or, you know, there seems to be a difference in culture, but is it different in terms of, you know, traveling from country to country within Africa, or
mm-hmm.
from community to community within Africa, within
mm-hmm.
an African country, that it is more radically different, I guess?
I think so. I mean, I think because, you know, first of all, we're more connected here in the States, you know, in terms of information sharing and more people having access to the Internet, which I think tends to maybe somewhat dilute our differences sometimes. So, you know, we're at least I'm aware of what someone who lives in a very rural area in the United States, I might not understand their life, but I've at least seen the show about them on TV or, you know, I have some image of it. Whereas in Africa, people are much less connected to one another. And historically, you know, they're from a lot of different ethnic groups, and the way that the countries have been cut out, you know, that was entirely done by the Europeans and the colonists. Mm-hmm. So, you know, different people within a single country might not have a whole lot in common, and they're just sort of arbitrarily put into this one country because, you know, that's what some international powers decided, how, you know, that they decided the border should be that way. So I think, you know, that's one of the, I think, sources of a lot of tension within Africa, you know, since most of these countries have become independent.
Well, as much as this is a fascinating topic to kind of linger on and talk about, you know, I almost want to go into, you know, is there any, you know, essence of colonization that are going on there that you mm-hmm. see and how that's affecting people? But this show is really about Darfur stoves, and so I'm going to turn it over to Hope to kind of go into perhaps the entrepreneurial aspect and
yeah.
solving the world's problems.
Yeah, and I want to go back because you mentioned that you came to you know, your MBA studies through working with microfinance,
mm-hmm.
and I know what that is, but I imagine that a lot of people do not know what microfinance is. And so if you could just give like a couple sentences, I mean, you kind of alluded to it already, mm-hmm. but if you could just explain what microfinance is and then it will bring me to the mm-hmm. entrepreneurship piece.
Sure. Microfinance is basically providing financial services to the poor and people who cannot access sort of traditional commercial banks. So people in very rural areas in Africa, Asia, Latin America don't have, you know, a way to, for example, borrow money or get insurance the way that you and I would. So microfinance refers to, you know, the whole industry that mostly it started as nonprofits, but it's over time become even commercial banks being involved in microfinance, providing financial services to these people. And before microfinance really took off, the only option was really usurers. So people were paying insane rates of interest that were basically further impoverishing them. So basically microfinance is the suite of services provided to them that, you know, related to finance. So insurance, you know, group loans, in some case, you know, guarantees, things like that.
And as I understand it, and this could be incorrect, originally the model, and it's Muhammad Yunus, is that
mm-hmm.
correct?
Who, that's right.
And the Grameen Bank, and he was originally just lending money to women, is that
mm-hmm.
correct? Because the men would actually, you know, wasted on alcohol and so forth, but women have this trust mechanism, is that correct?
That's right, and the Grameen Bank has had this model. They started, and I believe today, I haven't worked in microfinance for some time, but I believe they still have this model of working with solidarity groups, so groups I think usually mm-hmm. of five women who jointly get a loan, and the idea is that the social pressure that they put on one another would make them more likely to repay the loan. And you're right that they are, the Grameen Bank, I think, exclusively loans to women, at least it did in its early days. And I think that's reflected in microfinance as a whole. It's not only for women, but I think generally over the years, studies have shown that women tend to be better savers and repay the loans at higher rates. And perhaps more importantly, use the money that they make from their business, spend it more on their children.
That's really interesting because every time I've gone on Kiva.org, I've never really paid attention to it, but there's a lot more groups of women. Like there's mm-hmm. many more women on there than there are men that want loans.
Yeah, I think that probably reflects perhaps the organizations that Kiva work with might have a policy of prioritizing women, or I'm not sure if that's the demand or the partners dictating that that's who they want to lend to.
So, believe it or not, I am trying to get to Darfur.
I'm ready, and I should be turning the conversation if I was, you know, doing my job as a spokesperson.
But actually, I don't know if this is the appropriate time to play the clip, but I if you could just, you know, say a couple words, because, you know, you're coming from a background in development and you have an MBA, you've worked in microfinance, and you obviously are trying to solve problems. And I was wondering if you could speak to the role that entrepreneurship plays in solving social problems that you see in Africa and so forth.
I think there's two levels to that question. I think there's entrepreneurship and there's the markets. I've given a lot more thought to the markets question, but let me try to answer the entrepreneurship question a little more. One thing that we're seeing now is that more and more, you know, international organizations such as the World Bank or different funding organizations like foundations are trying to support entrepreneurs within Africa and within the United States that are trying to work in Africa to create new businesses. The idea being that, you know, innovation, the risks of starting a business in Africa might be harder, or like we were talking about, people don't have access to capital the way that they do here. And that really entrepreneurship is what has always led to innovation in our country and most developed countries, and that it's been under-supported in developing countries. And I think that that's slowly starting to change. So there are a lot of folks out there trying to create businesses that are solving social needs. The area that I think a lot about is the role of the markets. And specifically, you know, one of the things I've seen in international development that I think has been sort of a challenge is that there's often a lack of feedback mechanism to make sure that the inputs or the projects that we're doing are actually benefiting people. So, you know, in most cases, if you're going to a store and you buy something, you know, you're the consumer, and if the person selling something is selling something bad, people will stop buying it. So they have that feedback mechanism of, you know, people will stop buying their good. The way it typically works in international development is that nonprofits or aid organizations will want to help a community, and so they'll create, you know, a product or service or whatever, perhaps in consultation with the community, perhaps not. And it will be paid for by a third party, like the World Bank, for example. And so whether or not the community is happy with the project will continue on. And so there's this, the feedback, the whole incentive structure is a little bit warped. And so one of the things I think is really interesting about, you know, using the markets as a way of social change is that there's a lot more opportunity for feedback. So, you know, by selling items, you know, you can see, for example, selling stoves, we have a much better sense of, you know, do people value these stoves or not? And that would tell us if we're having an impact or not in a way that maybe surveying or, you know, doing other kinds of observations might not be able to tell us.
Okay, that's so interesting. And I don't want to, you know, get to this section yet because at the end I want us to address your most recent trip, but we did mention that you just came back from Darfur. Does that have anything to do with, you know, getting feedback?
Absolutely. Yeah. So most of my trip was focused on training our partner organizations in doing monitoring and evaluation of the project. So collecting women's feedback on the stoves, precisely that.
Okay, we'll get to that. Okay, so let's get into Darfur Stoves, the project. And there are several different players in this project, and going back to my original question about entrepreneurship and solving problems, you said, you know, let's make a distinction between entrepreneurship versus markets, and we have, you know, these social entrepreneurial ventures, which are good, but there's this aspect of the markets that is not really being fully addressed, which is this feedback mechanism. The Darfur Stoves project, as I understand it, is one of these social entrepreneurial ventures. And as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, it was originally someone in the Office of Foreign Disaster at the U.S. Agency for International Development who had an insight that stove technology was relevant to the welfare of the people displaced by the Darfur tragedy. Is that an accurate
That's
statement?
Right, that our project started when a scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory got a call from USAID, the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, asking him to look into a very serious problem. Now, I'm not sure if USAID was the first to really observe this, or they're really the first to contact us. But I think it's the problem, which I'll describe in a second, is something that all aid organizations who are working in Darfur observed. And it's something that's not unique to Darfur. It's something you see often in places of conflict where people are displaced. And the situation was basically this, that women were, you know, people were, they're called IDPs, or internally displaced persons. Basically, people were driven from their home by conflict and had no safe place to go. So they all kind of convened in certain areas that became camps, where international organizations such as the United Nations would provide services because the people no longer have their farms, for example, or ways to make a living. So they became dependent on aid from international organizations, and it was not and remains not safe to return home. And So that was the situation in Darfur in 2003. So all these people were going to these displacement camps. And Darfur is a very desertous area. So people were provided with food aid, so different grains and things to cook with and oil, but not actually fuel for heating and cooking their food. So the way that they were getting food is that women, or getting fuel wood, sorry, is that women would walk outside of the camps to collect the firewood. And this was extremely unsafe given that there was still conflict happening, and even today. And so women were often attacked and were subject to sexually based or gender based violence. And so because of that, you know, and because of the disastrous environmental degradation in the area, with so many people coming to a new area and all going to look for firewood, you know, there was definitely seen by a lot of organizations a need to lessen dependence on firewood, to reduce firewood consumption, and the need to go out and collect firewood. So women were walking, you know, up to 7 hours, three or four times a week to get firewood when they were being attacked. So, you know, people were saying, you know, what if we could reduce the number of times they need to go out, or reduce the distance they need to walk?
Fascinating. And so it was really people on the ground who saw this as a problem, and it's and somebody contacted this office that then contacted this scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, and this is Dr. Ashok, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly.
That's right, yeah, Ashok Gadgil.
Gadgil? Or
Gadgil.
And he brings a team of scientists, and he makes this stove. And then another player is this entity, I believe it's at part of the lab, TIS, the Technology Innovation for Sustainable Societies. Could you talk about what that is and the role that it plays in the Darfur Stoves Project?
Sure. So TIS is actually an independent nonprofit organization that Ashok Gadgil, the scientist at the lab, founded. And he founded it because he saw this real need. There's a gap between the research and development that was being done in the lab, for example, on the stove, but he has also worked on other products for developing worlds. He's well known for an invention called UV Waterworks, which disinfects water and makes it potable. And with that invention, as well as with the Darfur Stoves Project, what he noticed was that, you know, there's the lab where it's developed, and then there's international NGOs that are working in Sudan, but there's this huge, vast gap between them. And there's a need for some sort of intermediary organization that can help make sure that the products that are developed in the United States or elsewhere actually get to the people who need them most. And not only that they get there, but also that the products that people like Ashok, who, you know, basically did all of this developing of the stove in his spare time, you know, not, he wasn't being paid for it, and most of the people that have worked on this project until last year, almost everybody was a volunteer historically. So getting that research and development and connecting it with the people who see the needs on the ground, but also making sure that the needs on the ground were being are being fed up to the people who want to, you know, volunteer their time to help the developing world, specifically engineers. And so making sure that, you know, the process is demand driven by needs that are, you know, existing on the ground, and that when something's invented, that it actually gets the people who need it, and that there's feedback from those people, that, you know, the products are designed with, you know, with the women and their input In our case, you know, at every step of the way, we've had the women telling us what they like about certain stoves. You know, we didn't come in and just say, here's a stove. Actually, fuel-efficient stoves have been, you know, a project of many development organizations around the world for years. So when Ashok first went there, he brought a number of different stoves that have been used elsewhere and asked for the women's input on which one they thought was best for them. And then once they had sort of, you know, their preferred model, proceeded to then modify that stove over and over, you know, after getting many iterations of feedback from the women.
So interesting. So going back to actually your distinction between entrepreneurship versus markets as a solution to problems, mm-hmm. was it actually working with TIS and having, like, and seeing this entity being created that actually created that awareness in you about the importance of feedback? Did it come, is that where your awareness of that came from, or do you have that awareness before you encountered TIS?
Oh, interesting. That's a really interesting question. I think for me personally, that was one of the things that drew me to TIS, was that all of my, you know, work in various aspects of international development, I didn't talk about it, but I also worked as a consultant for the Rwandan government for about a year. And sort of looking at both the macro level and the very micro level, one of the things that I saw over and over is that, you know, as much as we, everyone's paying lip service to this idea of being participatory and, you know, being, you know, user-driven and responding to people's needs, I'm still seeing a lot of, you know, foreigners coming in with their ideas and kind of placing them on people. And so I had sort of made that observation before, and one of the things that made me really interested in coming to work with Darfur Stoves Project was that Darfur Stoves Project had that similar observation and had, from the very beginning, done everything they could to make sure that they didn't operate in that way and that they actually put the women at the center of the process. So it's something I had noticed, and it's actually one of the main things that made me think this would be a good fit for me personally.
Wow, that's so interesting. I actually have a clip that I would like to play, just switching gears a bit, because going back to, you know, this, we're trying to just get sort of the origin of how the stove came about. Mm-hmm. And what you said was that there was actually NGOs on the ground all noticing this problem, mm-hmm. that women had to walk long distances, and in that walk they were being assaulted and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to play a clip, and this is totally different. We're not talking about stoves in this clip. We're talking about cars.
Okay.
And this is actually Julia Fromholtz, and if you want to access this clip, it's on our show resources page, ethicstalk.cmish.edu. And this is from a talk called Strategies for Preventing Genocide and Mass Atrocities. And in this, setting up the clip, it's about 4 minutes, Julia Fromholtz basically uses the term enablers. And the point that she makes is that when we're talking about genocide, it's so complex that, you know, there are different areas on which you can focus that you may not have traditionally thought of. And in this clip, she's talking about that. And I would just like the listener to listen to this clip and try to frame for him or herself the Darfur Stoves Project within this narrative. So here is the clip. And again, it's about 4 minutes.
The mass atrocities of recent times have spurred a range of responses, from public mobilization to initiatives such as the Genocide Prevention Task Force, which has been mentioned already today. These atrocities and these responses have galvanized a consensus among citizens and among policymakers that confronting atrocities should be a foreign policy priority. But the track record of the U.S. and of the international community in dealing with these atrocities has shown us that they're extremely complex and challenging. Human Rights First, therefore, believes that an appetite exists for practical tools that can change the basic dynamics when atrocities are underway and contribute to efforts to halt violence against civilians. One potentially effective approach on which we are focusing is to focus on the means used to commit mass atrocities and on those actors who furnish the means. Mass atrocities are organized crimes. So crippling the means used to organize and sustain them, such as money, communications networks, transportation networks, and other resources, can disrupt the execution of these crimes. A key element of the organization that is particularly relevant to international responses is the role of third-party actors. history shows us that perpetrators are generally unable to carry out these crimes on their own. As creative and resourceful as they are, they're generally dependent on direct or indirect support from external actors, whether that is a government, commercial actors, or individuals whose goods and services enable them to wage attacks against civilians. Some work focusing on what we call enablers is currently being done, although without using that term. For example, there are several organizations that track arms and ammunition transfers and advocate for attention to be paid to the sources of weapons. Another example is the Enough Project's work on conflict minerals in Congo, which has brought great attention to that problem. And in fact, this morning, the House Foreign Affairs Committee marked up a piece of legislation aimed at tackling that problem. But this work is happening piecemeal, which means it's not coordinated and it's not covering all possibly useful targets. The U.S. government and others, but right now we at Human Rights First are mostly focused on Washington and New York, should look systematically at enablers when looking to prevent or respond to atrocities. Doing this would open up a new set of policy responses or a new set of pressure points. A quick example of this comes from the most recent report by the UN Sudan panel of experts. That group found that technicals, or 4x4 trucks that are mounted with weapons, contributed greatly to the widespread nature of the conflict in Sudan, or in Darfur, excuse me. They also found that more Toyota trucks that were later turned into technicals and then used in Darfur came from the official Toyota distributorship or dealership and secondhand dealers in the United Arab Emirates than from any other source. This information doesn't all of a sudden make this an easy question to solve, but that evidence could be used to develop various policy responses such as, or including sanctions. Cutting the supply chain for all trucks going to Darfur cannot, in my view, be done. But going down that road by drawing attention to these enablers, the ones who are selling the trucks, and then subjecting them to the greatest possible pressure could decrease the supply chain enough that perpetrators might end up changing their calculus. I don't mean to suggest that this would make preventing or that this or following enablers at all would make preventing or responding to atrocities easy. But it's because of the complexity of these crimes that we need to be looking at all possibly effective levers to prevent and mitigate them.
Right, so that was Julia Fromholtz. Talking about focusing on other pieces, and I just wanted to make the connection. We do have a caller on the line. We'll get to that caller in a second. But, of course, in the clip, Julia Fromholtz is talking about third-party actors and the situation with Darfur Stoves. It's the walk itself, which is the enabler. And I just think that that's another, you know, piece to, again, this is a very complex issue. So we have third-party actors, then we just have sort of like the natural ecology and the ecological situation that also is an enabler. So with that, we have a caller on the line, and let me take the caller. And caller, are you there from 248?
Hello.
Hello. Hi, caller. You're on Ethics Talk. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Actually, on the line, Andre is a very special caller who's also named Julia, and
okay.
It's Julia Fertile.
Know you, Julia. You made jewelry for us. Is that right?
That's right.
Wow, it's great to hear your voice. We've really appreciated all the support that you've given our project.
Thank you.
Yeah, Julia, my name's Nick, and I'm actually a Walnut Creek alumni. I walked the halls you once did, and now I'm at Central Michigan University. And really happy that you're on the line tonight, so thank you for that. And I also want to praise you for your entrepreneurial skill. I don't have anything as heavy to show for myself as you do. So I just wanted to ask kind of how did you come up with your idea to sell jewelry to support this project?
Well,
this is Andre. I'm so sorry. Can I interrupt you, Julia, for 1 second?
Yeah.
The building I'm in is having a fire alarm go off.
Oh, my God.
So I'm going to have to get off the air for about 5 minutes, and
That's
I will
fine.
Relocate outside and call you right back.
Okay, yeah, we hear the alarm. Be safe.
Sorry about that. Okay.
Not a problem.
Bye-bye.
Wow.
Julia, you're saving the day. Do you know what's happening?
Yeah.
Okay, so Julia, hopefully Andre is safe and is not, how bizarre.
Yeah.
I hope the fire alarm is a false alarm.
Yeah,
but Julia, tell us how you got started on this project of helping Darfur stoves.
Well, I heard a lecture, and the woman spoke about Darfur. I was horrified by the truth of what was going on in Darfur, and I knew that when opportunities arise for me to do public service, that I wanted to help Darfur.
And from that, have you just always been kind of interested in jewelry, or was that just kind of an idea that popped in your head, or do you have a history with making jewelry?
I have a history with working in clay, and I guess the jewelry kind of just arised from that.
And for our listeners who don't really understand the connection between Julia and Darfur Stoves, Julia actually makes jewelry, and the proceeds of which go to Darfur Stoves. So Julia's work, and Julia, you've just turned 14, correct?
Yep.
November 8th was your birthday, is that right?
That's right.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
But it's incredible. How much money have you raised by your jewelry sales for the Darfur Stoves project?
I've raised about up to date about $3,000.
$3,000.
Wow. Good job.
Thank you.
That's amazing.
And how does it make you feel knowing that you're doing that?
Well, it makes me feel that I'm really doing something to help people that really need help, obviously, and I really feel good about it, and I know that I'm doing something that'll help people that need help.
Do you feel more confident now that you've kind of, when you first started, were you kind of hesitant about starting up? Were you worried about, it not really being able to get off the ground and
I was hesitant about what would really end up happening, but I'm happy with the result.
So you heard the story on genocide in Darfur, and then you were horrified. And then how did you learn about the Darfur Stoves Project?
Well, me and my family were researching sites and agencies to give our money that I had been raising to. And we found this site, and I specifically wanted to help the women and children, since they are the ones that go out to the desert to collect the wood and to make the fires to cook their food. And this agency really seemed to help the women, and the stoves were efficient to their ways of cooking.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided that this would be the right site.
Did you do a Google search?
Yep.
Wow. Have any of your friends gotten involved with this as well?
Yeah, I've had a couple of friends that decided they wanted to buy some, and I've had some friends help me make them too. So, and I
Sorry, go ahead.
And I've also been selling them at Hanny Gallery in Harbor Springs and the BBAC in Birmingham.
Very cool.
Thank you.
This is kind of off topic here, but being from Walnut Creek and went to Walled Lake Central High School, I was just curious. Do you have Miss Hawkins by chance for a math teacher?
I do not have Miss Hawkins as a teacher, but she retired from teaching and she substitutes, and so I've had her as a substitute in math this year actually.
She's a goofy lady. I remember.
Yeah, she's great.
Math from her. Yeah.
So do you have plans? I don't know. Actually, we have another caller on the line. So, Julie, do you want to stay on? Because the caller may have a question for you.
All right, sure.
And it looks like the caller is calling from New York, so let me pick that up.
Julie, I'm back on the cell phone.
Okay. Is this Andre?
This is.
Okay, so... All right, so Andre, we've been talking with Julia. I don't know if you've been listening. I hope that the fire alarm was a false alarm.
I hope so, too. It seems unclear still, but I'm now leaving in a car with a friend driving, so I'll find out tomorrow.
All right. So, Andrea, do you want to ask Julia anything?
Yeah, well, first I'd like to thank you, Julia. We've really appreciated your support. We've been really excited ever since the first article that we saw in the Detroit Free Press. And I'm not sure if you're aware, but you're now on our website with your picture and everything. And I guess my question for you would be how you heard about the project.
I found the project, really. I was just did a Google search, and I found it online. We were really researching for a project. I wanted to work for a project that would help the women and children,
uh-huh.
so they are the ones that collect the wood.
Well, we are so grateful for your support, and I think you might be our youngest supporter who's really taken the initiative to raise money on your own. So, you know, congratulations for that initiative, and thank you again for your support.
Thank you.
And I just want to say that I learned about Julia in doing research for this show and actually learned about her on your website, the Darfur Stoves Project, starforestoves.org. And I saw that she was from Michigan, and this was very recently, right, Julia? And so it's sort of like a surprise guest that we're having. And so, Julia, you've done a great job, and you continue to do a great job. And before we switch gears and talk about Andre's most recent trip, anything else you want to say? You want to stay on the line, or do you want to hang up?
I wanted to ask about the vote that's going on in Sudan, and I was really curious if they know anything about this, if the women and people of Darfur have any ideas about it, and if so, what are their, like, I know that they would want to be separated by from the Janjaweed, but what are they saying?
That's a great question, and it's, a lot of people are looking to Sudan right now. So the vote that's coming up in January is for the south of Sudan to vote whether they want to be independent from the north. And most people think that the south is going to vote to be independent. Where that leaves Darfur, people don't know, because Darfur, from the north, the west, and the south of Darfur, there's three different states within it. They are all located in what's North Sudan. But apparently the government of Sudan is very worried that if the south chooses to secede, will the Darfur region follow suit and also decide that they want to be independent. And so when I was talking with the women, they themselves are not, I'm not sure that they are too, aware of when the vote is and whether they're going to vote. And especially even of the conflict, when I asked them, those women who had been chased from their homes, do you know why the people are fighting? A lot of them didn't even know the source of the conflict. They just knew that it came from the western part of the country is what they told me. So there really is like a lot of, an information gap there. And I'm not sure that they really, this is just my impression, I don't want to speak for other people, but my impression was that they just want peace, whatever form that comes in. They didn't seem to me to say, nobody brought up we want to be independent or not. I think they just want people to stop fighting.
Right. Thank you.
So I don't know if that answers your question. It's a really complicated issue, and there's still a lot of questions I have about it. But we'll definitely all be looking to Sudan in January to see what happens with the vote, and we'll be hoping that things remain peaceful.
I hope so, too.
One of the things that was discussed before, Julia, you got on the line, was this idea of enablers and things that enable genocides in Darfur to happen. And as Hope described it, one of the enablers was actually the walk to going to get the firewood. And so, Darfur Stoves solves that problem, or at least gets rid of that enabler of genocide. It doesn't, get rid of the genocide in general. But one of the things that was also brought up was this idea of Toyota, supporting these vehicles that were going in and delivering arms.
Right.
And I was just wondering about the role of the consumer I guess what you think the role of the consumer is in preventing things, preventing genocides to happen. And it seems like the case, you know, like Julia's work selling jewelry, you know, I would rather buy jewelry from Julia, you know, because mm-hmm. I know that her proceeds are going to something beneficial that,
right.
You know, that are a cause that I believe in. And so it
mm-hmm.
seems like there's also a level on which the consumer is directly responsible for the prevention of enablers of genocides. And that said, you know, yeah, I guess that's my point. And I was just wondering if any of you had any thoughts on that.
I guess I have a clarifying question. Do you mean consumers in the U.S. or in Darfur?
I mean in globally, I guess.
Uh-huh.
In terms of just the consumer responsibility.
Yeah. I do think
that,
there's a lot more information in the U.S. for consumers, so we are
right.
in a much better position to, I think, demand information about where our products come from, for example, you know, diamonds, to make sure that they're sourced ethically. In Sudan, you know, I think the role of markets is a little different. You know, I think everything has to do with economics, really. You know, when people are vulnerable and desperate, they're much more likely to be, you know, swept up and pulled into, you know, a rebel group, for example. They're much less able to defend themselves in their own villages, and they suffer much more when conflict does happen. So the more that people, you know, can be their livelihoods can be built during times of peace. You know, I do think that that is something that can help mitigate the risk of violence and genocide.
And I also want to point out that going back to this inequality regarding the information to which United States citizens have access versus people in rural Asia or Africa or so forth, that itself is an enabler because it seems like the more information that you have, the more you, and even if you don't have the power to, you know, arrest someone and bring them to The Hague, for example, the things like Julia is doing, if people were aware, more aware of how these different pieces all played a role in this atrocity, the atrocity would be less likely to happen. So I just want to say that the information asymmetry itself is also an enabler.
I completely
agree.
Maybe
there's hope for the internet.
I completely agree. And I think one more element that we haven't really touched upon is, you know, the conflict over scarce resources. And that's another area where the stoves
mm-hmm.
come into play, because mm-hmm. wood is extremely scarce in Darfur. And so, you know, because our stoves use less than half the amount of wood as the traditional way of cooking, that lessens the sort of competition for a scarce resource, which,
mm-hmm.
you know, again, could be a source of conflict.
Right, and I think we're getting to, you know, this. We have like 8 minutes left in the show, but you're starting to talk about the impact of the stove, and so one of the impacts is that, you know, you're lessening the demand for scarce resources because the stove runs on fewer resources, and that in itself is a cause of conflict. But could you talk about other effects that the stove is having?
Absolutely. So, you know, originally when the project started, most women were collecting the firewood, as we discussed. But today what we see in some areas, there's almost no wood within walking. You could walk for a whole day and not get to any wood. And so what's happened is that middlemen have sort of sprung up and now bring wood to the camps on trucks. And what I learned on this recent trip, actually, is that a lot of times these trucks are being, they're military trucks. And so it's the military actually making money off of bringing wood into the camps. And so women actually have to buy the wood. And then you have to ask, okay, if they're buying wood, how are they, you know, getting the cash to buy this wood? And what it turns out is that they're selling some of the food rations that they get from the United Nations. They either trade and barter or sell them for cash to get firewood. And so it's sort of a cool twist of irony that, you know, they're eating less in order to be able to cook the food that they have, because they're getting rid of some of their food. So one of the things that we look at in measuring our impact in our surveys and discussing the stove with women is, you know, how much of your food rations have you had to trade in and how much less do you trade now? And what we found was that when we first started and we surveyed the women, we found that more than 80% of them were using some of their food rations in the last food distribution they got. They get it every month. They were using some to buy firewood. And we don't yet have that number for the most recent group, but we do know that their spending on wood has gone from $5 down to, you know, about $2 a day. So the amount of money that they actually spend on wood has decreased. So that's allowing them to have a lot more money. Another impact is the time that is saved. So for the women that collect wood, you know, the hours and hours that they save not collecting wood. And for those that were buying wood to begin with, the stove actually cooks almost 10 times faster than the traditional way they cook. And I should probably explain that most women, before they would get a stove, they normally cook over 3 stones, basically the way, you know, you or I would have a campfire, where they put the wood on the ground and perch a pot on 3 stones. And that's one of the least efficient ways to cook. Most of the heat that's created is lost outside, you know, in the gaps, and very little of it actually goes into the pot. So it not only is inefficient, but it also cooks slower. And our stove, they told us, you know, whereas their traditional meal normally can take an hour or more, it can be 5 to 10 minutes with the stove. So they have all this time now that's available. And when we ask them what they do with their time that's available, you know, some women told me that they get to rest, which is, you know, something they probably need a lot more of, considering that, you know, the average family size is 7, so they're looking after many children. They're, you know, fighting to support for their families, or I should say struggling. And some of the women told me that, you know, they're able to cook faster in the morning, and because of that, they're able to leave their homes earlier to go and look for daily labor. So a lot of the women that are either in the camps, or we also help women that are in towns, because not everyone who's been displaced goes to a camp. Some people go into towns, and they are squatters. And so they go in and look for daily labor, cleaning houses or, you know, making tea in the market. And because they're cooking their breakfast for their children much faster, they're able to leave the house earlier and are more likely to find a job.
What is the average meal for a Darfuri family?
That's a great question. It's called a sida. It's a porridge, a very thick porridge, made, I'm not sure if it's from wheat or sorghum exactly, but it's very thick. And I should explain that the stove is specifically designed for cooking the meals that they eat the most often. So unlike our stoves here, which can pretty much accommodate many different pot sizes and shapes, the stove, to keep it inexpensive and still be very efficient, we have it made so that it fits the exact pot shape that they have in Darfur and is made for cooking the acida that they eat. So they eat this acida with a sauce, and they stir the acida very vigorously with a long stick. And so one of the things we did in making the stove appropriate for the women was add feet to it so it's more stable, because they're stirring so vigorously. An earlier version of the stove was not very stable. So that's one example of how we've modified the stove to fit the women's needs.
Right, and that also illustrates your point about the importance of feedback, correct?
Absolutely, right.
Julia, you've been quiet. Do you have any questions left? Because there's 2 minutes left.
No, I'm just listening.
Okay. So we only have 2 minutes, and we did mention that we wanted to at least address your most recent trip to Darfur and for 3 weeks and in 2 minutes. I assume that was like a fact-finding mission where you're perhaps looking to see if you can improve the stove further?
That's right. What we really wanted to do, so over this last year, we've distributed about 9,000 stoves. And prior to this, we had worked with another, right now we work with an organization called Oxfam America. And prior to this partnership, we worked with another organization called CHF International, where they made the stoves, but we gave them some input. So the way that we currently make the stoves, where the pieces are made in India and then they're assembled in Darfur, so we're creating employment as well in Darfur, this is relatively new to us. We've only been doing it for a year. So the real purpose of the trip was to see how this new process is working and how the the stove, the 9,000 that are being distributed in this new process, how they're helping people or not, and if anything has gone wrong with the stoves that the people received. Some of the women received the stoves last January, some of them around May or June. And for the most part, we found that there were absolutely no problems. We found a few little things we could tweak with the handles. But mostly I was going to get, you know, some in-depth and face-to-face interviews with women, and also to provide training to our partners, both Oxfam America, and we also work with a Sudanese nonprofit called Sustainable Action Group, which is only working in Darfur. And I was training them on how to do surveys to understand on a much larger and in a more scientifically rigorous way what the impact of the stove is. And there's so many things that go into doing those surveys, you know, from how can you ask a question so that you're more likely to get a response that, you know, where people aren't telling you what they think you want to hear, or, you know, sometimes people feel pressure from their local community leaders to say one thing or another, you know, different things like that. So I spent a lot of time working on the questionnaires and discussing how we can address some of these challenges to make sure that we're getting data that's reflecting the true impact of the program, because we're all interested in learning, you know, how are we helping people and what could we do better?
Wow. Okay, so maybe with 10 seconds left, I'm not even going to finish my thought. I'm just going to say thank you, Andre,
sure.
And also Julia. And I think another show perhaps is in order to really get at the details, because it's really fascinating. And thank you both. You've been listening to Ethics Talk, and happy Thanksgiving. DarfurStoves.org is the website to learn more about this fascinating project. Good night and happy holidays.
Bye.
Good night.
Good night.